Welcome to another episode of The Breakdown. I'm so excited for this conversation tonight, and I got to have a little bit of an insider's preview last week. I'm not bragging, I'm just saying it did happen. So, it is what it is. Person we're going to have a conversation with tonight has been on the show once before. His conversation and his story is so powerful and so important. I can't say enough nice things to introduce this guy. So rather than just pumping his tires for the next 20 minutes, I'm just going to bring him right in. I'm very excited to welcome back to the show, recovery and harm reduction advocate, Guy Felicella. Guy, thank you so much for coming back, sir.
Thanks for having me, Nate. Happy to be back.
Is it okay that I introduce you as recovery and harm reduction advocate? That's a fair assessment of what you do, right?
Yeah, for sure. I support, both harm reduction services and recovery services. Yep.
Okay. And I wanted to sort of emphasize that out of the gates because the first part of the conversation has to do with why I got to have lunch with you last week, quite frankly, because you came to Calgary. But as much as I'd like to be like, ah, oh, Guy came to Calgary to have lunch with me, that's not what originally brought you to Calgary. So there's been some media coverage. I just want to get out of the way and let you tell the story of what happened, and then I might have a couple of follow-up questions. But what brought you to Calgary, and can you go take us through some of the twists and turns of the trip?
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, what a roller coaster ride that was. But the Recovery Capital Conference was something that I hadn't experienced in Alberta, and so it was on my list to go and check out, as I go see many conferences and like to go and listen to speakers and people talk about recovery or harm reduction. And so I purchased the ticket to come to the event. And then I was talking to some people from Mom Stop the Harm, because they're based in some of my friends are based in Calgary, to let them know, like, hey, I'm coming to the Recovery Capital Conference. Do you want to go for a coffee? And everybody was all excited, like, yeah. And then all of a sudden, I was, one of the moms contacted me and said, hey, what day do you arrive in Calgary? And I said, on the second in the evening. And they said, we're putting on a harm reduction event on the second. And I said, oh, that's cool. What's it about? And they were just, to give some inspiration. A lot of people struggling, frontline workers are, witnessing people, lose their lives, and just, having I understand, mentally exhausted. And so they asked if I would come to do a talk to inspire everybody that the work that they're doing is noted and helping. And so, I agreed, and then they told me it was earlier in the day, and so I readjusted my flight to come in the morning to come do this talk. And then it was with Esther Tailfeathers, was the other speaker at the event, along with Elena and others. I guess a few couple days before, I get this email from Last War organizers saying that I wouldn't be allowed to attend the Recovery Capital Conference because I was speaking at an advertised event at this harm reduction facility, and some of the people who are at the harm reduction event had protested before and made smearing comments towards Last Door staff. And so, I read this and I'm a little shocked, and so I contact both of the organizers from Last Door, first shoot them both messages and no response, call both, no response. And I'm just kind of really shocked that I was being denied entry because I was speaking at a harm reduction event, and contacted my boss that was coming to Calgary as well. And she reached out and no response. And then so, after looking at the email, obviously I was felt pretty rejected, obviously, like, getting denied for something that I haven't done anything towards them. And So I posted it on social media, and then the rest is kind of history. It kind of blew up, and I mean, man, the amount of people who reached out across the country. I mean, holy, so I'm still getting text messages from it. And then also too, knowing that I had already booked tickets, hotels, all that stuff was already done, and how important to come and do the event at the harm reduction event was, to go and just do that and then readjust my plans to go and meet people. People were telling me that they were going, still going to the Recovery Capital Conference, and that, people were meeting me outside of the up the road. I mean, I had so many coffees and lunches with people from the Recovery Conference, and so, I got over it really quickly. There was a massive outpouring of support, and even a lot of people who don't agree with, some of the views that I have. They were even reaching out to me saying, "Hey, I just want to let you know, I know we don't agree on a lot of things, but I think this is absolutely wrong. Your voice is definitely needed. You're an important voice in the conversation." And so, I went to Alberta and got to, I mean, especially doing the talk at the harm reduction event. That was really powerful to me, because I mean, there were a lot of people. A lot of moms that lost loved ones there. People were really moved, and I was moved, and it's very humbling. I get impacted by people's emotion, and yeah, it was really rewarding. And I got to hang out with some of my good friends that were at the conference as well. And I just think there was a lot of shock. And then I think also too, the Last Door has known me for, gosh, over like 20 years. And I worked for the organization for 2 years. I helped people in that organization. I held service positions in that community. I help constantly people. I have friends still in the community. I still go back and help people. I help people who went through the program there get jobs. I mean, all I try to do is just really try to help people. And I even for being even just a former employee and a person in recovery, who's in abstinence-based recovery as well, I felt like, hey, there should be just enough respect to call me and say, "Hey, we have some concerns that you're speaking at this event. Can we alleviate these concerns and talk about this?" And it would have been simple. I mean, they've called me for other things. If they need to find a family friend in the downtown East Side, they call me and I'll go help them. And so I just found it was really kind of sad that they wouldn't pick up the phone just to talk to me about it. And so it really, I guess, at the end of the day, says more about them than it does about me.
I'm curious, just for our listeners. I mean, Last Door, the people who said that you wouldn't be welcome at the Recovery Capital Conference. Just to be clear, what's the relationship between Last Door and the conference?
Yeah, I mean, that I just think that they put on the conferences in Alberta as the recovery capital. I know they put on functions in BC as well. I was just at their recovery capital conference in BC. They were just taking pictures with me at that conference before the Alberta conference, which is kind of baffling to me. It's like, hey, let's take a picture, giving me hugs, and at seeing them at recovery day as well. Everybody's giving me hugs. And I mean, if there's some animosity there, it's like nobody's saying anything, right? It's just like, let's take a hug and a picture. And I'm kind of like, okay, like, cool. I mean, I honestly, one of the things that I've learned in that community through recovery is that it's always about principles over personalities, right? Like, I mean, and recovery is about communication and like, saying, "Hey, listen, guy, if there's something that I mean, and honestly, if there's something that I've done, like I mean, at least tell me so I know, and then we can try to move forward, right?" But that unfortunately didn't happen. And but it honestly, it's sad, because there doesn't need to be this division, right? Like, I support abstinence-based recovery, and I support harm reduction services. There's things that I think when I was there that I saw with my own eyes, that I've applauded Alberta for a couple of things that they've done, which is obviously treatment is free for people that want to access it. I think that's really good. And then obviously the access through OAT through a phone call, I think that's great too. But also too, I think, we all have to take a good look at, the amount of lives that are lost across Canada and say that, hey, it there's not this one silver bullet that's going to actually alleviate or reduce deaths. It has to be really all the tools. And that's just something that I've known from my own experiences in life, but also in what I do and what I see every day. And so for me, it's like until we actually get to a place where both are equally funded and supported, sadly, this is going to continue to go the way it's going.
I mean, at the very beginning there, and I just want to make sure that I heard it correctly. You said that one of the main organizers of this event was Dr. Esther Tailfeathers. Is that correct?
She was the keynote speaker at the harm reduction event. Yes.
Okay. And that's a big deal name. And I really,
Huge.
I think that it's important to highlight the credibility that somebody like Dr. Esther Tailfeathers has. For anybody who's unfamiliar with her, she was one of the leads at the Indigenous Wellness Corps with Alberta Health Services for a good chunk of time. She's demonstrated to be herself a highly principled individual because she was one of the individuals who left the Indigenous Wellness Corps after Dr. Dina Henshaw was supposed to be hired in there, and then that was vetoed by people in positions of power. I feel like I can say that fairly safely. She's demonstrated a long-term commitment to wellness for Indigenous peoples, particularly Indigenous peoples in Alberta. She's a highly, highly credible speaker. So this isn't just like we've got Bob, and Bob's going to talk about why he thinks that everybody should be able to use heroin at length with just let everybody gets free heroin. That's not what this was. I think it's really important to highlight that, because it is so, there's at any event, I imagine that you're going to have people in attendance who some people might find problematic, and you're going to have some people are going to find polarizing. But it's wild to me, and I just want to make sure I'm understanding this correctly, because it's wild to me that they would say there's some people at this event that we don't like or that we find disagreeable. Therefore, we're going to say you're not the person that we don't like. You're not the person that we find disagreeable, but because you're going to be in the same room as them, you don't get to come to the conference. Like that's am I getting that right?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, really, that's really it. Yeah.
I did Premier Smith speak at the conference?
Not the harm reduction conference.
The recovery capital. I know that her chief of staff was there, but was she in attendance at the conference?
That I didn't, I didn't really ask. I mean, I think she might have been, but I wasn't, yeah, I wasn't really too sure.
Let me rephrase the question. Did you hear about her being barred from the conference?
No.
Okay. Because one would think that if you were going to make the argument that if you have a public affiliation of any kind with problematic individuals, I mean, I can just running down the list from memory, Premier Smith posed for pictures with somebody who said that had a t-shirt that was wearing, said there's only one gender. She also posed for pictures at a fundraiser with James Bowder, who was one of the organizers of the convoy. He was the author of the Memorandum of Understanding that said we should overthrow the government. So, I feel like if you're going to say this one time you were with a person that we find disagreeable to how we do things, it kind of has to cut both ways.
Yeah, I mean, you'd think, but also too, what also a lot of people that were at that conference support drug user organizations as well. So I was kind of, I was, you know, after I had gotten over it, I was kind of almost laughing because I was like, hey, careful, they might do a background check on you and you know, find out that you're supporting this and they might not let you in.
Do you think it was just the tattoos? Was it the ink?
I don't know. It might have been. Yes, it might have been.
Well, I make that joke because, I'm so grateful that I was fortunate enough to be one of the people who got to spend a little bit of time with you when you came to Calgary. I want to talk more about some of the other organizations and groups that are far more significant. But I'll be honest with you, when you and I were sitting down for where we had our lunch, I personally got a big kick out of how uncomfortable we were making some other people in the room, because we were in a fairly ni nice establishment, and I was dressed street and you were dressed street, and both of us had our ink out, and there were a couple people that were just like, oh my God, I have to sit beside these people. It was fantastic. So I was just wondering if that maybe played in a little bit to the conference, but let's talk a little bit. So you went to this harm reduction event with Dr. Esther Tail Feathers as the keynote speaker, which is, like, again, just about as credible as you can get. What were some of the other things that you got to see in Calgary? What were some of the programs or the people that you encountered in Calgary, whether it's from the abstinence-based recovery or from the harm reduction or from both? What were the ones where you came to Calgary and, like, oh, you know what? Maybe they're getting this part right.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, obviously, as well, my buddy runs a recovery society in Alberta, and it's more along the lines of also likes to do a lot of the physical fitness aspect of it. So, you know, just hanging out with him and listening to him talk about it, and he used to be in BC too. He moved to Alberta, and I'm just so proud of him for what he's doing and trying to help people. And you know, he has the belief, you know, doing stuff, physical fitness, doing, you know, emotional therapy as well for emotional regulation and group, and you know, just kind of blending the aspects of health, wellness, and recovery all in together. And I was just like, man, like, you know, hats off to you. I mean, I see this guy gets up at like 5 in the morning to hit the gym, and I'm like, I don't know how you do it, man. And I mean, you know, any. The healthy eating part of it. There's so much more to it than, you know, just stopping the drugs. It becomes like a lifestyle, and he tries to pass that. He passes that on to people. So hanging out with him was really the highlight of just hearing what he's doing in Calgary. And then also to, man, like, shout out to the harm reduction peeps there, just doing what they got to do to help people. SafeLink was incredible. Street Cats was incredible. I mean, there's so many, and you know what? From all sides of it, right? From the recovery sides of it and the harm reduction side of it, a lot of people in Calgary do in Alberta doing some fantastic work. And you know, I get that. You know, take out all the politics aside, right? There's a lot of good people doing a lot of good stuff, and I saw that with my own eyes in Alberta. And you know, makes you feel good, like, just to see, because you know, I've come from Vancouver, from, you know, the beginning stages of harm reduction, and to what people are doing whatever they can, man, you know, to support people. To me, that's the gift, right? Is that we just show up and suit up because people need us to, and seeing the people going out on outreach and outreaching people and jumping on that train or whatever. I mean, that train thing you guys got going on there. It's
We call it the
kind
C
of cool.
train.
It's cool. I mean, it's cool. Yeah. So just doing all that and then talking to the staff. And heck, I was just sitting in the staff room with all the staff at SafeLink, and a couple of clients were hanging out in there. And you know, we were just talking stories. And you know, when you're breaking bread with people that are on the street, there's no hierarchy or anything. You know, you're just talking, right? And even a couple people from the street said, hey man, I appreciate, you know, the chat. And you know, you just try to make people feel like, you know, that you see them and you care about them, right?
Yeah. And I love that you highlight that part, because And I mean, obviously I have a special affinity for the Street Cats because we did the walk along with them, and that was such a quite literally life-changing experience for me. But the relationships piece and building that trust piece is it seems like it's such a big, if not the biggest component in getting people to a place where they're able to access services and try to figure out what their recovery is going to look like. Why do you think it is? I mean, like in the first conversation that you and I had, you were very clear. You take sort of a why not both approach to addressing the deaths that occur because of the toxic supply. You're an advocate for both abstinence-based as well as harm reduction in order to get people to a place where they can maybe explore that as a long-term path for them. Why do you think it is that there is that animosity that exists towards the different models? Like, and I have to, maybe I'm in the wrong circles, but like in my experience, I don't see any of the harm reduction folks saying, no, abstinence is absolutely not an option. I hear them saying abstinence will work for some people. But there's very, very clearly, I mean, the fact that you were blocked for coming to this conference for simply being willing to go to an event that talks about harm reduction, that's why is there so much fear around the harm reduction piece?
It's a good, I think it varies between people. I think people, I think you have one side that solely is looking at the addiction side of things, right? And harm reduction doesn't, it's not necessarily addressing addiction, right? It's keeping people alive. Like it's trying to reduce the harms caused by the toxic drug supply. And the some recovery advocates I know, they believe that harm reduction just enables people to continue to keep doing what they're doing. And it's so far from the truth. It's like, if we didn't have any harm reduction, people would continue to use drugs. Like if just say no work, then tell me why hasn't it, right? Like it's like, yo, like somebody, please hit me up with the memo. Because it just doesn't stop people from using substances. And so, I think people also blame a lot of the societal issues in our society with harm reduction, like, public safety and crime and everything else that, you see poverty, homelessness, people on the street. I mean, everybody is blaming harm reduction. Like harm reduction does one thing. It reduces those harms from the drug supply. It doesn't solve homelessness. It doesn't solve poverty. It doesn't give people housing. The societal issues aren't being, they're so far unaddressed for so long. And really, it's just easier to blame harm reduction than it is to work on all the societal issues to be changed. Now, also, as well, is that I've never, ever, ever seen a harm reduction worker, if somebody wanted to go to detox or recovery or treatment, say that that's not a good idea. Like never. Always the place that got me out was harm reduction service. It wasn't recovery people coming to the downtown east side to say, hey guy, come on, let's go to recovery. It was actually harm reduction people saying, hey dude, you should really think about this. Because this is twice now that you've overdosed. And it's like, okay, yeah, let's just, and they would even encourage me, just guy, take a break. Like, sort yourself out. Like, please, we care about you. We love you. And be like, okay. So, just to have this division is really sad, man, because it's uninspiring, the rhetoric that goes back and forth. And you know who suffers out of all of it? The people that are struggling, right? It just creates this stigma, and unfortunately, the rhetoric is really driving people further away from actually reaching a path of wellness. And so, that's the part that I've witnessed and continue to witness is that we really have to stop fighting and start being supportive. Now, what happens also is that one is funded a heck of a lot more than another. There becomes, this kind of rift between, like siblings, right? You're in a fight for because I'm not getting enough attention either. And so that's why I keep saying until we actually, fund things equally and support people and try to do our best to I'm trying to stop the deaths. I that's really for me is about reducing the amount of lives that are being lost. And sadly, just nobody's been able to do that.
One of the things that I find difficult for me to understand, and I want to explore the division piece that you're talking about a little bit in a sec, but one of the things that I find difficult to understand about the abstinence only approach is that you really, my understanding is you really have to be ready for it, because the relapse rates that exist are not inconsequential. And I mean, we have everybody has a story, I'm sure, where they know somebody who, or they know of somebody who went into recovery. They did the work, they worked the program, they got out, and at some point they had a relapse. And the danger of not having any sort of harm reduction mechanisms in place is that because of the toxic supply, you can have somebody who's done the work, they've worked the program, for whatever reason, they've relapsed, and they go back to a toxic supply. And because the supply is toxic, they die. And no amount of treatment is going to help them in that moment. So how do you see a pathway out of this division? How do you see a pathway to getting people to, especially people in the corridors of power, to understand, there's different things that we're talking about here?
Well, addiction is a chronic relapsing condition, right? Chronic. What chronic means, like, you're going to go through some learning challenges, right? Like when I look at my own life, it took me 26 years to get 1 year sober. And I went to treatment over a dozen times, tried to get sober over 50 times. And in that 26 years that I got 1 year, there were so many attempts in between where I had 2 weeks, 1 week, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months. And then even after 26 years of getting 1 year, I went back out for another 4 years, and then I overdosed six times and now have 11 years. So you have to understand that the majority, and I mean the majority of people, pretty much all people, go through ups and downs in the treatment industry, going through relapsing, using again. And sadly, I've seen many people, many go through treatment, probably a lot of people on the street as well who have already died, have gone through treatment at some form in their lives. And sadly, with no harm reduction safety net underneath it, or no access to safer substances, or no access to a supervised consumption site, their only option was to use the drugs on the supply on the street and then use them alone and die. That's the part that we're missing. It's like you don't walk in a front door of a recovery society and walk out the back and your life gets better. Sure, it gets a little better, but I tell you, the stuff that happens in treatment when you're insulated in treatment and you're around people, you're supported. But when you get out, the game's out here in the real world, right? And life has its ups and downs and challenges. Also, too, what happens is that the lack of housing for people after treatment, after they finish 1 year in treatment, where do they go? What about getting a job? You got a criminal record. People are bringing up your past. You can't get hired. It's like we want people to get better, but yet we keep pulling them back in. And also, too, something that shouldn't fall on just governments, but there's corporations and companies that are in our society that aren't hiring people or giving them a shot, right? It's like they complain about everything as well. Public safety, we want this, like, don't, hanging out my doorway. But yet when people go through treatment, the industry doesn't hire them either. And so you have this, people don't have much on the purpose side of things, right? And staying on welfare is kind of sucks. Like, you know what I mean? You're flat broke all the time. And so what do you got to do? You got to go back to what you know, survival, make money, go back, start selling dope again. All those things start coming up. And sadly, you tail back into a tailspin. I mean, I've been through that revolving door for like 30 years, right? And honestly, nobody hired me when I got out of the downtown East Side. I had to volunteer. And I volunteered at a recovery house in Surrey and did the groceries and helped the clients, take them to medical appointments and stuff like that. And then the guy started paying me cash under the table, and then people started to see some value in what I was doing, and they were actually like, "Hey, you're actually pretty good at what you do." And I was like, "Thanks." And they, and then I got my first job, and well, the rest is kind of history. But man, there's a lot more than just getting off the drugs. And two, also, a lot of times too, for people is that they would go to treatment, but they don't want to get off everything, right? They want to get off the drug that's causing them the problem. But I know a lot of people that have told me many times, "Guy, I'd go to treatment right now if I was allowed to smoke cannabis." And I'm like, "Hey, I'd let you smoke cannabis. Like, if that got you off shooting fentanyl, I mean, like, that's a good trade."
Yeah.
But unfortunately, they do the abstinence part of it, and that's oftentimes, not a real world solution for a lot of people, right? So you have to have different models, and unfortunately, it's either this or that.
With the abstinence piece, like one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, I've been sitting on this question for a couple of days, knowing that we were going to have this conversation. But one of the things, like, it's a common thing in to one of the messages that's out there is don't use alone, have a Narcan kit. And so when we take a look at people who are actively using that we consider at risk for overdosing, for those people we'll say, hey, you know what? Don't use alone. Make sure you're using with a friend. Make sure you're doing the test dose. Make sure that you've got an Narcan kit available. All of that kind of stuff. We'll communicate that to those people. But it almost seems like one of the dangers of the abstinence is the only answer messaging that we're seeing from some corners is if you relapse, which is for the overwhelming majority of people, especially if it's their first time in treatment, pretty much an inevitability. If you relapse, you have failed in some way. That seems to
Yeah.
be like the subtext of it. Instead of saying, if you relapse, use with a friend, make sure you have a Narcan kit, make sure you do a test dose. Like, understand that this is a real risk of your chronic condition. And if you find yourself in that place, for God's sake, be safe. How do we allow for people to pursue abstinence and encourage people to pursue abstinence, but also have that built-in piece of like, but you know what? If it doesn't take hold the first time, that's okay. Please stay alive.
Yeah, recovery perfectionism. You know what I mean? It's non-existent. This is the thing. It's like we're human beings. You can't do it perfectly. The unfortunate thing with relapse is that it's attachment with failure, right? This again, right? That is a tremendous amount of shame for people. That failure in itself is the stuff that just drives you into isolation, right? And I think one of the things that I'm often telling people when I get them into treatment, I tell them right away, like, I mean, listen, there's no guarantees. And I want you to know, like, hey, listen, we can try this and let's see how you do. I had one guy, we got him into treatment and he lasted about, I think it was almost 28 days. And I saw him on the street and he came up to me and he's like, "Oh man, like, I'm sorry I let you down." And I was like, "What are you talking about?" And he's like, "Why? I stayed, it was like almost 30 days." And then I was like, "So you stayed 30 days?" And he's like, "Yeah, like almost, yeah." And I was like, "Well, when was the last time you had like 30 days sober?" And he was like, "Never." And I was like, "Well, then that's amazing, dude. Like, good for you. Like, pal, don't beat yourself up because, like, I mean, And he kind of, that's how our negative mindset goes too, especially when we struggle with like a multitude of complex challenges. We beat ourselves up, and so you have to reinforce, like, dude, it's okay. Like, that's pretty amazing, man. Good for you. And then they feel a little bit, they can release some of the shame. That was always an attachment. I remember one time the insight got me up to a treatment facility, and I left. And I was so ashamed because I left treatment, and they worked so hard. I remember them arguing on the phone, like, "No, this guy needs to come." And they got me to go, and I went, and I lasted a couple months, and then I relapsed, and I was so ashamed. I wasn't going back to the injection site. And a nurse, a harm reduction nurse that works at the injection site, saw me on chi in a Chinatown using on a park bench, and she came up to me and she sat down on the bench, and I turned and I looked at her, and she's like, "Guy, what are you doing?" And I was like, "Oh, hey." And she goes, "Why haven't you come back to the injection site? We've all known you've been in the community. We haven't been able to see you, Guy." And I was like, "Oh yeah, I feel like I let you guys down." And she, "I just feel bad. You guys worked so hard to get me into recovery, and here I am again." And she was like, I don't care about that. I care about you, Guy. Like, we want you to come back. Like, this is dangerous." And lo and behold, she made me feel like, okay, like, it's okay, Guy. I came back. Guess what happened? I overdosed two more times at that place. I would have never made it. Like, I mean, like, here's somebody, she could have kept walking by when she saw me on that bench. And her name's Marjorie. And I mean, we're colleagues, we became colleagues and friends. And I mean, and every time I share the story, I used to share it without her name. And she one day texted me and she said, "I know who that person was." And I was like, "You damn right, it was you." And I mean, this is the amazing part of people that I love, man. Like, from both sides, man. And I wish both sides would see it. It's just amazing people in harm reduction that really care, and there's some amazing people in recovery that really, really care too. And I think what, all the other outside noise about it is just like background noise. Like, don't let it beat you down. Like, you know what I mean? After all this happened, I mean, you know what? Just makes me stronger. It makes me feel like I'm doing the right things. And for me, I'm just going to continue to do what I do because it's obviously pretty effective.
Do you think it's fair? And I mean, I'm gonna ask for your personal perspective on this, but do you think it's fair to almost talk about recovery like it's a skill that you need to learn, in the sense of like right now, if I was to go to, I decide, you know what I want to do? I want to learn how to walk a tightrope. That's what I really want to do. That's the thing that I want to learn how to do. For some reason, that's what I've decided. And so I decide I'm gonna walk a tightrope. I can guarantee the very first time that I step out on that tightrope, if I get more than a step, I'm doing pretty good. I'm gonna end up in the net. And the important part is to go, you know what? You got to learn how to go all the way across and then all the way back and then all the way across. And the more support that you have, the more encouragement that you have, the when you have those inevitable falls because you're learning a new skill, that's okay. That's part of the process. And I like, am I getting it wrong, or is that like, because I just think about like the last time you were on the show, you talked so much about underlying trauma and you talked about underlying medical conditions, things like ADHD, that kind of stuff that makes things harder for people to navigate the day. And when you throw in a healthy amount of trauma with that as well, you have to learn how to be with that and manage that at the same time as manage the addiction piece. And of course, there's going to be falls. Is that, am I sucking? Am I doing a disservice here?
No,
Like,
I honestly, I'm my head's going bonkers thinking about the tightrope is recovery, right?
yeah.
And guess what the safety net is underneath? That's harm reduction, man. Because
That's,
you go and fall.
yeah, and that's okay.
And it's okay. Yeah, it's okay. And you know what? I actually call it like a relay race, like a baton passing. It's like you just keep passing the baton back and forth as many times as it takes. And if somebody goes into, like, I mean, I try to tell this to people, it's like, somehow you go through treatment and you want to just go smoke cannabis after, like smoke cannabis, right? Like, if I mean, hey, listen, if that helps your anxiety, a lot of people are dealing with a lot of challenges, anxiety, and sometimes, listen, I don't know why people make such a big stink about it. It's like, well, if I'm going to go to a psychiatrist and they're going to give me some clonazepam that I don't want to take because it makes me really feel lethargic, or I can go smoke a couple blunts and then, I'm going to feel okay. I'm like, yeah, what's wrong with the blunts? And it doesn't mean that, that recovery isn't valid. It is. Like, I mean, so I think with recovery is really, there's so many different approaches for it, for an individualized approach, but also like abstinence is part of that as well. Like, I mean, I'm just not a social drug user, right? It's like I use drugs, guess who's showing up? The cops are coming. Like, they coming. And so for me, it's like, yeah, no, I understand. But I also understood because I made, when I do talks and stuff like that, I talk about the grind. I talk about how hard it is. I talk about how it's not easy, and it's still not easy today. I talk about all that stuff. I think what happens to some people in recovery is that they put on this facade that everything is like picture perfect, but it's not always. And a lot of people don't reach out in recovery because they feel other people will think that they aren't working their recovery, and then it's a weakness. And I'm like, no, when you are working your recovery, when you tell people you're weak, that's when you're actually doing something. Humility is probably one of the biggest impacts of recovery, having understanding for the person that's continuing to use substances. I remember pointing, if I point fingers at that person, I might just find myself back there, right? I've been humbled by life so many times. And, when somebody goes into treatment, I'm like, hey, man, you call me no matter what. Like, I'm just proud of you for making the first step. Celebrate that you're trying, because trying doesn't mean I don't care. The outcome is I don't have any knowledge of the outcome. But what I do want to applaud for a lot of people is that there's people getting up every day and trying to do something better. They're just not achieving what they're looking for yet. But that's why the importance of having a harm reduction safety net underneath all of that, because sadly, I've seen so many people when I worked in the recovery industry complete treatment, go use again, and they're gone. I just had a good friend of mine, Patrick Evans. I mean, he went to treatment, flew back into Vancouver. They found him at, his dad called me at 3 in the morning from Montreal. They found him in the hotel the day after he got out of treatment. I mean, just heartbreaking. And so there's so many stories like that. And also too, in all the talks that I've done, the amount of people that have reached out to me over the years talking about their loved ones that went through treatment and they're gone, or being kicked out because, they were using, they used, smoked a cigarette or stole something from a store, they're gone. I mean, hey, listen, if this is a health issue, we can't keep people out, kick people out when they make a bad choice or make a mistake, right? I don't know any other health condition that you're going to do that with.
I don't think you're wrong, and I can tell you, like, I've heard people use the comparison to stuff like diabetes, where if once you've been diagnosed with addiction, it's like being diagnosed with diabetes. You have a chronic condition you're going to live with life, and it's going to take some time to learn how to do it. And even if you do everything right, there are still going to be days where, for some reason your sugars go high or your sugars go low, and it's important that people rally around and support that. Yeah, so I want to ask you, I mean, you're in BC, and lately BC's been getting a lot of airtime in Alberta politics for I'm going to say stupid reasons, but that's my own take. But I'm hoping that maybe you can help make some sense of things. It seems like a lot of this kicked off when the Premier of Alberta, Danielle Smith, decided that she was going to refer to a couple of different things in the legislature and in a couple of press conferences. One of the things that she referred to was a piece that was written based on a memo from July of last year. That was a memo that was sent out to nurses in particular, giving instructions in regards to how to deal with a couple of different things. Now, one of the frustrations around the memo for me is that it's very clear in the memo, hey, you know what, nurses, we're not cops. And so we don't have any legal powers of search and seizure. So don't try to exercise any powers of search and seizure because you don't have the authority to do that. So there's that piece. One of the other things in the memo that was glossed over was the fact that the memo was very clear that there was still a no smoking policy that was very much in place in the hospitals. But nonetheless, we've had Danielle Smith come out and say, BC has legalized weapons and open drug use in all of the hospitals. And that was then amplified, justified. I don't know what the word is. I want to say bullshitted by a column by somebody who's made their opinions on harm reduction very clear. He's a writer of sorts, I guess. I would probably call him a creative writer. But he published a story that had a couple of anecdotal, unsubstantiated reports of nurses who had experienced exposure to drug use inside of the hospitals. And therefore, see, drug use is running rampant in BC. I still think that the policy of no drug use, especially no smoking of drugs inside the hospital, is still, last I checked, that was still in place. But I'm hoping, what's your thoughts on this whole debacle?
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know what to say. I mean, I mean, from a guy that spent years in the hospital with multiple infections and, life-threatening infections, I mean, you're not allowed to sell drugs, smoke or smoke in the hospital, smoke drugs in the hospital. You're not allowed to deal drugs, not just in the hospital, like anywhere in Canada. And even, over 2 decades ago, nurses would never ever take your substances anyway. That's not their job. However, if you did, let's say, which some people have smoked in their room, a cigarette, or maybe they did smoke drugs, immediately the smoke alarms go off and nurses come flying in, and you're not allowed to do that, right? Which is kind of just, I don't know why, people say the things they do. I was actually just in St. Paul's at the Road to Recovery area couple weeks ago. I mean, honestly, it's a well-oiled machine of a hospital. I mean, it's really busy. Doctors, nurses, people in there for appointments. You have also too, you have people, like, I mean, who are struggling with the toxic drug supply that have overdosed and are in the hospital, or have bacteria infections or sepsis or endocarditis or osteomyelitis. They're not there to be treated for their addiction, right? They're there to be treated for what they're there for. And so obviously when people still use drugs, they'll go outside on the fourth floor and use them there. I mean, the reality is that we have a toxic drug supply that's killing people, causing irreparable harm. It doesn't reduce, it's, you know what I mean? It's like the worst of harms. You're going to die. And so you really have to have substantial places for people to have access to use their substances. Now, also too, on top of that, the healthcare system and the nurses, which are a lot of them are my colleagues, I mean, they're crushed, man. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there's people overdosing, there's people very sick, there's other people in the hospital as well that are struggling, right? So, I mean, all of this has really compounded the health services. And it's a very stressful environment for a lot of people as well. So how do you make it to where everybody is actually safe? And sure, you know what? There's some people that don't follow the rules, but a lot of people do follow the rules. And the ones that don't follow the rules, you can't kick them out either, right? You just have to try to work with them as best as possible, because if you can't kick people out with like a health condition that could kill them, especially if it's like endocarditis or osteomyelitis, you just can't do it. So there's this big issue that we have to really address, and I'm glad to see that the BC Minister of Health came out to say that there needs to be proper services for people to have access where they can, go and use, and we can direct them there. And so that is a great first step. And obviously you have to remember, six to seven people die every day in British Columbia, right?
I gotta say, I love there's an irony that exists for me in that everybody lit their hair on fire over people breaking the rules because these weren't policies that were in place. I mean, the smoking drugs in a hospital, the smoking anything in a hospital is against the rules, period. The thing that makes a weapon is the intent behind it. And that So, and of course, nurses who don't have any powers of search and seizure shouldn't be asked to deal with weapons. The fear mongering and the furor that people lit up over this appear to have effectively created supervised consumption sites in every hospital in BC. In effect, because now there's going to be a space in every hospital where people can use, and be safe. So that seems like a win to me. I don't know. But the notion, and this is, we do the Alberta politics here, but the it's so wildly hypocritical to me that Danielle Smith will say, oh, there's people in BC and they're breaking the rules and that's just unacceptable. Where in this province, we just mandated that there's certain roads that the police can't use photo radar on anymore because too many people were getting caught breaking the rules. So, like, it's of course, people are go there will always be some people who break the rules. And the question, I think fundamentally should be, are the rules justified? Certainly the rules around not smoking in hospitals is entirely justified. But secondary to that, how what's the safest way that we handle this situation? And I think that having an effect, a supervised consumption site in every hospital where people can go and use and be safe, and not put healthcare practitioners at risk. I think that, maintains the rules of we don't want people smoking inside the hospitals. We don't want nurses or anybody else being exposed to stuff. But at the same time, we also recognize that if somebody's there for, two broken legs or an amputation or who knows what, asking them to deal with that and also all of the other things that they're using for is unrealistic. I haven't seen a response from Smith yet to the announcement from, but she's based all of her stuff on pretty much fiction anyways. This is the reality. I'm curious though. I mean, you and the writer of the piece have gone back and forth a few times. Do you think that there is a responsibility for people who have some form of a microphone, whether it's a silly ass podcast or they're a national columnist for a inflammatory newspaper. Do you think there's a responsibility to be aware of the fact that these days, if you say something that aligns with a government's position or an organization's position, and you're just writing an opinion piece, you could be legitimizing policy that's legitimately causing harm. Do you think that more people who decide to say, I've got something to say, should be mindful of that?
I mean, you got to always remember that, especially when you have a platform, like I find a lot of this stuff from a lot of different writers can be severely biased, which is the part that's very concerning, right? And it's almost it's it and it is in a way, in a sense, politically motivated as well, where maybe you support a specific government, so you'll write towards that, right? And that's the part where I've said it all along. I just wish there was no politics involved in any of it, and that the money was really funded through public health services, and have a public health approach on this, and you could have the abstinence-based detox and treatment and recovery, and you could have, places where people could access to go on medications. And hey, maybe if we even really got lucky, we'd have a cannabis facility or something for people that wanted to continue to smoke cannabis and go to treatment. But yeah, no, it is very, it's very impactful. And oftentimes I find myself like, one of the things that I swear I was always told in recovery, Guy, live a life of integrity. And that meant something to me. And so for me, when I see somebody write something, right, oftentimes, especially some stuff I don't even read, but if it's flagged for me to read, then I'll go through it. And then I guess, for me, I'm my ADHD kicks in and wants to, well, let's just dive into this thing, right? And then I track data and then try to come up with the perspective of the truth, or you look at, maybe you have a 96-page document that you had to read, and you found out that it was a paragraph somebody used at the end of it, and it's just like, well, no, there's 96 pages that got to this one little component that you're talking about here. And so, yes, no, kids don't get fentanyl. It's like, you know what I mean? That kind of stuff, right? No, that doesn't happen. But you really, those are the things where some stuff is cherry-picked. And that's the part that's the it needs to be a balanced approach. Like that editorial that I saw the other day, from the Globe and Mail, where it broke down like the provinces and pointing fingers at each other and all that stuff. I was like, wow, this just so probably actually one of the best articles I've read in a long time. Like seriously, like but just bang on. Had BC, Alberta, Saskatchewan, Ontario, how many beds BC has, how many beds Alberta has, just everything. And I was just like reading it and I was like, this is what I've been saying. I have been saying this for like, yes, this is it. And so it was nice to see a well-balanced approach. And hey, I agree. Like, you know what? There's the stuff on safer supply, even in the article. Yeah, there needs to be a bit of a reform to it so it works better for people. But it doesn't mean that you go after it and talk more about the response to the toxic drug supply than what's killing people, which is the toxic drug supply. I find that people are writing more on the response than what's actually killing people.
Yeah.
It's almost like it's a, like a complete, like a deflection. Like, like the shell game. Whoa, where's the ball? Right? I'm looking for the ball, and it's like, oh, it's right here. No, it's over here. And you're like, wow. This is where this kind of stuff that's being put into society is that, some people will believe it.
Yeah, it's frustrating. I can tell you for those of us that are involved with this show, one of the biggest frustrations that we deal with is Danielle Smith says something outrageous, and we go, okay, where's the kernel of truth and where's the 99% bullshit? Because there's going to be, you could bet, and I'm sh don't get into gambling, but I'm sure that you could earn a reasonable living betting on where's the bullshit in what the leader of the province is currently espousing. And that to me is incredibly disappointing because arguably she has one of the biggest microphones or platforms in the province of Alberta, and somehow she's getting information from these, I don't know, hack maybe writers who are grinding a particular ideological axe, and she's going, well, they're writing in the news, so it must be true. And then she's running with it. And it's just like, at some point, somebody's got to say, maybe we should be responsible with the words that we use if we're going to claim to be journalists or credible or something like that. I want to ask one more question, but before I do, because I really want to end on this question, is there anything else that you want people to hear? Is there anything else that you want to say? Is there anything else you want to say about your trip, or the conference, or the floor is yours before I get to my last little request.
No, I just said, I mean, obviously what I'd said already, really, that you guys just have a, I mean, you have a, there's a lot of good stuff that's going on in Alberta. It just needs to be a lot more on all fronts, right? So the people were fantastic. I mean, man, I had a blast. And obviously too, there was other people that came from other provinces that were there. So that was it was great. And obviously chatting with you and many other people. I mean, I had a great, I honestly, and you know what? Calgary's a is a beautiful city. I mean, it's pretty nice, man. Like I was saying, yeah, this is and it seemed a little, I mean, I'm from Vancouver is a little, it's a lot fast paced. I didn't get that vibe with Alberta, which was really kind of nice. It was more chilled back a little bit, which is refreshing for me because sometimes I get I gotta slow down as well. It's just go here. And so when I got there, it was nice just to kind of chill and just really not have so much on my plate. And yeah, great bunch of people. And yeah, it inspired me. It did inspire me, in the way that because you when you I'm a visual guy too, and when I see things, yeah, Alberta's got some really good folks there doing some really good work on both sides, harm reduction and recovery, and I know that'll continue. So good on Alberta.
My last question for you, sir. You shared on the Twitter machine a story about a talk that you did recently and the impacts of that talk. And I was wondering if you'd be willing to share that with our audience tonight.
Yeah, man. Wow. So I went to Hugh Boyd High School and kicked out in grade eight for drugs and brought back 43 years later to talk about drugs. And it was their substance use conference held in the gym. And I went in and and did the talk. And I mean, man, I had a lineup of kids after, many of them talking to me about their own struggles, tears. People were just, I mean, it was a very emotional day. And I hung out for after the talk, talking to the kids for like an hour and a half. And then, I go home and next day I get this email from one of the counselors, and she just was like, said amazing things about the talk, but she said the impact that you had on our school is that the kids that reached out for help the next day came to the counselor's office. There was a lineup of kids asking for help and support, and I was just blown away. And she was saying they're still talking about you today. All the kids are, the whole school is. You really impacted it in a way that I've never seen in my life. And I get a lot of heat on social media for me supporting both harm reduction and recovery, but to get an email like that, and then the teacher just reached out again today and asked, we want to get you to come in twice a year next year. And then they were asking about this year. And I said, listen, I'll come back and do a smaller talk with all the kids in a smaller setting so we can have, a good chat before summer. But man, the interesting thing too is one of the kids was telling me, she's like, Guy, I try, man. Like I try, I know it's not the best thing that I'm doing, but she says, it's just so hard. And I said, I know. But I said, what's amazing for a 17-year-old girl like yourself is that you have so much more awareness now than I ever had at 17. I said, you already realize that you have issues and that you want to stop it. I said, that's huge. And she was just moved. And actually, one girl said to me as well, she says, you were so relatable in so many ways through your talk, but you made me actually look at what I have and not take a moment for granted. And she says, I'm going to live my best life. And I was really, that was probably the most humbling experience that I've ever experienced. Probably the biggest impact that I was told. I mean, I just don't know the impacts. I mean, but that was really, really a humbling moment for myself. And just to go in and they, somebody to say that you're an amazing storyteller and just don't stop sharing your story and you're saving and helping people and so many people in so many different ways. Really kind of, after everything that happened in Alberta and with not being allowed to go to the conference, it really kind of, said to myself, like, okay, you know what, man? Yeah, I know I'm helping people. And I'm gonna keep sharing my story openly, honestly, in the hopes, as a cautionary tale for people that they don't go down the same path that I did. And if they ever do, that it's okay. Like you can reach out and get some help and support because, there are people that care about you. And so on both sides, harm reduction and recovery.
I know that you'll never say what I'm about to say, but I'm the guy perennially with two middle fingers up in the air, so I'm absolutely going to do it. What you just shared is so powerful and it's so beautiful. And last door, that's what you shut your door to at this conference. And if you don't make this man a keynote speaker at your next conference in Calgary, you are speaking more about what your priorities are, and you are missing opportunities that people very clearly need. So there, Guy,
My
you
man.
so much for taking the no, but for real, man, like you do so much good work and it's so authentic and it comes from such a place of sincerity. And I take real issues with anybody who is working in any capacity for outreach, going, ah, but you're not good enough. That to me is like, that gets my little fingers start coming up right there. And for them, for anybody to do that with somebody like you who is so authentic and has done so much good work and has overcome so much and is an example for so many people, it's just like, I'm gonna say some things. So thank you so
You
much for
say
taking. Thank you so much for taking the time. It is always a pleasure to talk with you, sir. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to hang out with you when you had some time in Calgary. Thank you so much for the work that you do. And I will never, ever, ever, ever forget the expression on the face of the dude who was sitting beside us when you talked about the when you shared the garden shear story. And that's all I'm going to say. But that was priceless. You can't buy that kind of entertainment. So thank you for that, sir.
Anytime, my friend. It was a pleasure, and we'll look forward to the next time we see each other for sure in person. We'll go have another. We'll have some more laughs. There's
Awesome.
more laughs. It's good to laugh, buddy. It's good to laugh.
100% is. Thank you so much, guy.
All right, my friend. We'll talk soon.
And that's it for another episode of The Breakdown. As always, if you appreciate the kind of content that we're trying to produce here, we would love nothing more than if you thought about signing up to be one of our Patreon sponsors at www.patreon.com/thebreakdownab, where for just the price of a fancy cup of coffee a month, you can help us continue to produce this kind of content. whether you're listening to the audio version of the podcast, in which case, maybe leave a review and a rating, or whether you're watching it on one of our streaming platforms, we want to say a big thank you to everybody who is part of the Breakdowns audience. And as always, take care of each other and keep the conversation going.